At the close of our discussion last time on the subject of release from subjection to the physical body, we made an observation that we have to deal with prana, that is the life force, as involved in the physical body, and the life force as it acts on the mind and in the heart. Today we will discuss in certain detail the exact process of this operation of the life force on the heart and the mind, and the method that is adopted in the yoga of knowledge for releasing ourselves from this subjection. It is the business of life force in this world to move and to act. It always insists upon darting forward in the movement of the senses, in the movement of thought, seizing an object and reporting it to the intelligence. But this life force that acts as a channel, that acts as a link between ourselves and the things outside of us, is not a pure channel. It is mixed with desire, impelled by desire, and its report is tainted with desire. It is but rarely that happens that the life force brings back the contact precisely in the form in which it is presented. If it suits its desire impulse, there is the reaction of like, of preference. If it does not, if it conflicts with it, the reaction is one of dislike. This duality of like and dislike, pleasure and pain, is the contribution of the desire-infested life force to the situation. A seeker of the yoga of knowledge has necessarily to take account of this feature of the working of the life force. There is first the mind of the senses, sensational mind, the sense mind. Thereafter the emotional mind, and thereafter the thought mind. Now all these three are mixed in their operation with the workings of the life force. The sense activity is completely vitiated by the preferences, by the likes, repulsions, attractions of the desire-led life force. Similarly, the emotional mind, what we call the heart, presided over the emotional mind, is likewise interfered with by desire, likings, attachments, rebuffs, repulsions. All these based upon a basic desire, they misreport the situation. And this activity led by the desire soul on the wings of the life force, we call the soul. Actually, what men call the soul is not the soul at all. It is what Sri Aurobindo calls the desire soul. The desire mind bases itself upon the soul projection in nature and masquerades as the true soul. That is at the root of 90% of the unhappiness in the human world. Similarly, in thought mind, whether the thought mind is conscious of it or not, the bias imparted by the desire mind perverts the judgment of the thought mind, inclines it to certain preferences, choosings, and give what you may generally call a biased view of everything. These three pollutions, the pollutions by the desire soul of the sense mind, the emotional mind, and the thought mind, they are to be first remedied. And how are we to remedy? The process is the same: detachment. The being, the Purusha, has first to detach itself from involvement, take up a witness position and say to itself, I am not this life force, I am not this desire mind, I am not even this sense mentality, this emotional mentality, this thought operation. They are the workings of nature, specialized workings of nature on definite particular planes, which are twisted by the desire-dominated life force. Once the mind learns this habit of what Mother calls standing back and refusing its complete identification with the nature processes, a certain gulf is created. No doubt, the gulf is again overwhelmed in the avalanche of the movement of nature, of desires, passions, and seekings of the desire soul. Still, man is an awakened being, a conscious being, and he can re-exert his will to disengage himself from this helpless involvement and effect a kind of bifurcation in time between himself, between itself, and the operations of nature. So done, the mind comes to a position when it looks upon itself as the central being, the mental Purusha, on whom everything else depends. But beware, even this is a projection of the ego in the mind. As I once observed, the ego has any number of avatars. It masquerades, it hides behind many specious pleas, and the fact that this ego point, this ego is senior in time than our mental being, our vital being, even the physical being, gives it a certain advantage. For as you know, the ego was the first centralizing point formed by nature in order to give a certain fixity to the flux of life. Before the ego forms, it is only a flow of life, a flow of mentality. When nature laboriously, industriously erects, fashions a point around which it organizes the activity, the flow of experience, the entity, the ego entity is formed. In course of evolution, this entity grows into a personality. This ego has got such a powerful hold that even when, by a rigorous system, process of disengagement, non-identification, one releases oneself from the activity of the ego, the egoity, the spirit of the ego remains. Men who have got release from the formulated activity of ego flatter themselves into the belief that they have been liberated and actually launch into a career of a magnified ego, a magniloquent career of egoity. For the spirit of ego sticks, and as long as the ego or egoity is strong, the psychic being can never emerge. Even a ray of the psychic being, when it is let loose, the ego captures it, gives it its own coating, and claims for it a further lease of life. The prescription for this malady of the ego of the traditional yoga of knowledge is to affirm to oneself that I am not this personality, I am not this ego. Negatively, to affirm, to negate identification with the ego, and positively, to affirm one's identity at the core with the reality. The reality, which reality? There is a reality within, there is a reality without, there is a reality beyond. The traditional yoga of knowledge points to that essence of reality within yourself. That point in the core of the heart whence all derives, which waits for your approach behind 100 veils, that they call the self, which is called the monad in Western philosophy. This self, this jiva, as it is called in Sanskrit, what we may call the being, the real being, is associated with nature but is not a creature of nature. Actually, it is a projection of the Supreme Self that sustains, that presides over the whole universe. Projected in the individual scheme, it is the self, individual self. And what we call nature is, at a certain level, its own power. On a lower level, we call it prakriti, nature. On a higher level, we call it puissance, power, shakti. So in the original status, the self, the jiva, the being is the master. But we do not realize that poise of mastery immediately. In the yoga of which we are speaking, the process begins by quieting the restless movement of the mind, the agitation of the vital life force, so that in the calm, in the silence that ensues in the being, some reflection of the inner self may be experienced. True, periods of this experience are clouded again and again when we descend back into the life of nature. But each time there is this delving within, there is 1 inch, 1 centimeter, if I may say so, more that we have covered. And whatever may be the appearance, though we think we are coming back to the same old movements of nature, in fact, it is not so. We are 1 step removed from the old involvement. First the witness, then the silence, then the reflection, thereafter continuous remembrance of what has been experienced, though momentarily. Recalling it, visualizing it in the mind, re-experiencing it in the consciousness, creating grooves in the consciousness of the same movement of that radical experience, predisposes the whole being to a repeat experience, to an enlarged version of that experience. And so, one progresses more and more inward till one finds a sudden snapping of the knots of the desire soul, and one lands in the lap of the inner monarch. That is only the first step, though the capital step. After realizing this inner divine, this inner self, the next step, according to the yoga of knowledge, is to realize that this reality, this irreducible reality within, is none other than the Absolute, than the Brahman. The identity is there always behind the nature. The process is to relax, to get back and find that link between my reality, myself, and the Supreme, the Absolute, the Brahman. There are differences among philosophers, people who have realized, have got spiritual realizations as to the nature of this, what they call the ultimate experience. Whether the reality that is myself completely merges in the Supreme Reality and is no more, or it realizes its identity but continues its distinct individuality against the background of the absolute reality. These are matters to be discussed in debates of philosophies, but have no relevance to us. For we are concerned with the practical dynamics of the situation. And both Sri Aurobindo and the mother have pointed out that it is not only possible but inevitable as a result of an integral approach and an integral practice that the individual reality can at some level feel one with the Supreme, but simultaneously in another poise, in another level, it can maintain a certain relation of intimacy, of mutuality with the Absolute. It is possible to realize both. So far, regarding the contribution or the vision of the traditional yoga of knowledge. To the seeker of the integral yoga, this is not enough. It is not enough for him to realize his own divinity and either merge in the Supreme Divinity or have personal relations with it. His perception, his realization of the divinity within is not complete unless he realizes the existence of the same divinity in others. Till he can come out of his own being, the confines of his being, extend his consciousness and embrace the whole universe in the endless arms of his consciousness, his realization on earth is not complete. It is only as his mind breaks its frontiers of thought, his heart opens its gates and receives the contacts from outside without restriction, returning the reactions not of hesitation, not of hiding, not of repulsion, but one of broad return of compassion and love. Till that takes place, the second step of the yoga has not been completed. In a side observation, Sri Aurobindo makes a pertinent remark on how what we call or what generally passes for compassion and expressed in terms of pity, helping others, he says it is not really born, most of the cases, out of genuine love, out of genuine identification with others, but a camouflaged regard for one's own feelings. One cannot stand the sight of the suffering of somebody else. There is a revulsion. My nervous being is unable to stand the sight, and to prevent that, to save myself from that situation, I go and help. Now this kind of help, based upon self-regard, has no spiritual value. Spiritual value ensues only when I feel the pain of another in my being, and as a result, something appeals to that part in me which is a reservoir of love, soothing love and compassion, and there is a float of that sea of love and compassion. That is a spiritual help. This is inevitable in this second step, what is called the cosmic realization, the realization of the cosmic self. The individual self has to realize its identity with the cosmic self. Even then, the journey is not over. The individual self and the cosmic self are both projections in creation of a transcendent self which always exceeds these two formations of the self. It is certainly not beyond in the sense of being, of having no relations with the earth, as in Buddhist philosophy, as in the Advaita philosophy of Shankara, where the absolute is conceived as something totally transcendent of this universe and the individual. When we realize whose nature all sinks into a negation, all looks like a figment of imagination or dream, that is not the truth, though certain experiences give an appearance of truth to it. The reality is there, no doubt, transcendent, but it is an absolute which contains the relative. The relative has not come out of nothing. The relative has come out of the bosom of the absolute. So even while exceeding it, even while transcending it, the relation continues. All the three terms of the reality, the transcendental, the universal or the cosmic, the individual, all these three are real as related to this manifestation. And in the measure in which one releases oneself from subjection to the body, from subjection to the ego sense, in the life force, in the mind and in the heart, one begins to experience the truth of this triple reality of existence. How this Supreme Self takes different positions on different planes of existence and manifests itself as a particular Purusha, the particular presiding being on that particular plane of existence, will be the subject that we'll be dealing with in our subsequent meetings. Any questions?
Physical mind, the same as the sense mind, the thought mind, what are the four minds?
The classifications of the mind differ according to the standpoint. The classification of which I spoke, the sense mind, the emotive mind and the thought mind, they are of the ancient Indian system, which is followed in this traditional system of knowledge. Sri Aurobindo's classification is one of physical mind, the vital mind, the reasoning mind, then the higher mind, illumined mind, and all that. So there is a certain overlapping. Though what you said, that the physical mind can be broadly equated with the sense mind, since it depends entirely on the activity of the senses. Though the physical mind also has its thought content. Once I remember when there was a criticism, it was in 1940 or 41, about some book of Sri Aurobindo by a professor in Calcutta, and I had replied to it. Sri Aurobindo had practically summarized one para of mine in one sentence. He wrote in the margin, "The physical mind also thinks." So, it has a thinking activity. Thinking activity does not belong to the thought mind alone. The vital mind also thinks, but as mother says, it thinks very cunningly. In philosophical parlance, you can call that thought mind which moves in the realm of ideas, to which thinking is more important than anything else. Nothing is true to it unless it is thought out. That is called the thought mind. The dominating force is reason, logic. It is only when man realizes the limitations of the thought mind that he opens to the realms above the mind. Though for most the problem doesn't arise, because in them even the thought mind is not active. They mostly live in the physical mind, in the vital mind. And in yoga, when they are told to silence, it is these layers, the physical and the vital layers, that are quieted, surrender to the action of the higher force. So the mixture, the confusing activity, the doubting activity of the mind, thought mind, does not enter into many people who are undeveloped in the normal sense. So it is yogically an advantage not to have an active thought mind.
Is there a psychic mind? Or a subtle mind?
No, psychic mind is this, that part of the mind which is under the influence of the psychic, receives the psychic content, rays, influence, and reacts from that basis. That is called the psychic mind. The mind, that part of the mind that has come under the governance of the psychic being, that is called the psychic mind. Though the position proper of the psychic is not in the mind, but in the heart, its influence may spread into the mind, but it acts here. There is, for instance, when the psychic perception is active, we may think that our mind is perceiving, but it is this psychic perception that reflects itself in the mental discrimination. The impulse is from the psychic.
Then when Sri Aurobindo speaks of receiving messages and illuminations from the higher light.
Yes. Not the psychic. Not the psychic. The mind, as far as it is developed, that falls silent. And when it is silent and does not interfere, then the messages that come, the messages that come down from above or rise up from below. You follow me? They are received here. Mind. The mind can receive message from the heart, that is the psychic, as also from the spirit above. Man being what he is, the mind is the receiving center.
When someone opens to the heart,
it's not through the thought mind. It acts through the vital mind. And that is why, after the inspiration is over, the man continues to be an ordinary man. If the being had developed, if the mind, the vital, they were in tune, purified, then each such infusion, descent of the inspiration, should make a tremendous difference in the consciousness of the person. When it does not, it means only a part has been instrumentalized, like some painters. They are wonderful when they are in that mood, when they are doing the work. Mother has so often spoken of certain people, how marvelous they were when they were composing music, when they were chanting. But afterwards, when the inspiration stopped, they turned out to be very ordinary. It is only if there is a certain kind of integration where there is a working, at least a working unification of the being around the developed part, that what is received in the developed part can have a powerful effect on the whole. That calls for yoga, whatever name we may call it by. I wouldn't speak of the soul of India. I feel it is the earth soul that is opening to the light and the truth that the mother is manifesting. And all obstructions are arising to prevent this fulfillment. They are to be worked out, and the ashram and Auroville, being the focusing centers of this struggle, the difficulties, the obscurities, the resistances, as also the intensity of the workings, are most prominent here. Things are as bad in other countries as in India, but they are secondary. Once there is an integration, fusion between the aspiring soul of earth and the manifesting truth of the new consciousness, all will change in all countries. Till then, in this period of transition, in this period of incubation, many things are happening which are never expected, showing human nature at its worst. You wanted to ask him? Unless one is truly detached, one can't share the experience of another. If one is involved, it is only a superficial sense contact. My feeling that pain doesn't help you in any way. When one is detached, one is able to take on consciously your pain and lessen your burden. It is a conscious taking on oneself, not a helpless subjection which comes by attachment. By detachment, you separate yourself, you rise above nature and you command the situation. When you see a suffering, just as a physical mother, when she sees a child suffering, picks it up, soothes it and restores it to its normalcy. Similarly, when a yogin takes on, sympathizes with the sufferer, means his consciousness takes on his burden to the extent that is possible, to the extent that is permitted by the other man's karma, and in the very process of taking it, which he is able to do because he is detached, consciously, the other person gets the relief. I distinctly remember when I was 13 or 14, I used to get burning sensation in my ears, and my ears used to be red. No doctor could help. Nobody would know. And it happened so often, so many times, that when my guru was with me, I never had that burning sensation as long as he was in the same room. It never occurred to me, but suddenly somebody remarked that his ears were red and they were hot. He took on my suffering. This is, I am speaking from personal experience. If one had no detachment, with all the sympathy, he could not have relieved me of that pain. I am speaking only of physical pain. There are all kinds of pain, physical pain, psychological pain, spiritual pain. Indian tradition speaks of three kinds of suffering. One cannot enlarge one's consciousness. One cannot embrace in consciousness others unless one first attains a degree of detachment from nature. Otherwise, our consciousness is bound to our individual nature.
Can one concentrate on one point and like open it to both?
Actually, the psychic has been compared to a flame, to a point of light. It is the final end of the spirit in one's body. So when you contact the psychic, there is an automatic link with the spirit of which it is a projection in evolution. It is the spirit that stands aloof, which we call the central being. It is the same spirit when projected in evolving nature, in evolution, that starts as a point and develops into an entity, that entity develops into a being, that being develops into a personality. So, when you contact the psychic, when you concentrate upon the psychic, there is an immediate response from the spirit, whether here or there. One need not shift the center of concentration. One has to allow it to develop. There one has to be an observer. The operation of concentration should be left to itself. And it may go here, it may go there, it may go here, whatever it is, we have to be uninterfering with our mind. There is not this dimension of up and below. It is our mind that translates this happening in terms of vertical and horizontal, because we are used to this space formula. There are stories, actually renderings from life, where in that state people have wondered whether the soul is in the body or the body is in the soul. And Sri Aurobindo has even narrated a story from one of the scriptures as to the people, the disciple wondering whether the rider is on the the elephant is in the rider or the rider is below the elephant. The whole thing gets topsy-turvy from our standpoint. Till the perspective settles sufficiently plastically, then we know there is neither above nor below. All is one. Depends upon the angle from which we see, the poise from which we experience.
Is that what Mother means in her message, when?
Yes. When the physical barriers of space are broken down, and there is one psychological space in which we are conscious of anything happening anywhere, if only we want to know, that is the attainment of the universal consciousness. It is not that we are always conscious of what is happening everywhere. But when we want to know, you have only to will it and you know it. What, for instance, what is going on in your mind? What is happening at the moment in the United States? Because there is no physical distance. In dream, for instance, it gives a certain idea. In dreams, where we are sleeping, we are covering the whole world. We travel, we go about, we meet so many people, and that experience at the time it happens is real. The order of experience is different, but the experience is real nonetheless. The senses do respond, the senses that are active in dream state, they do respond in the same way as the physical senses do when in the waking condition. So that shows the possibility of transcending the barriers of physical space and division. all, the final snapping is always preceded by a lot of unloosening. Conscious, willed loosening by oneself, a loosening by a series of shocks, unwelcome experiences, which hammer and loosen the tangled web. But the final release comes from a sudden snapping. The Upanishad speaks of the knots of the heart snapping by an act of grace. It does not happen by human effort. That final release from the knot is beyond human capacity, because it has come into being before man has been born. It has been fashioned by nature, and it is a higher nature, a stroke of grace that alone can snap it. Different mystic traditions give different imageries. When that knot snaps, the final knot, the revelation of the inner divine is a fact. The possibility of realizing the universal divine is near. The door is open to the ascent above. With the being, it is possible to go into the beyond, leaving the heart not where it is. In the traditional methods, they just leave the whole system, the body, the person, as he is. Take a hook here through the mind and first have a certain mental experience, mental realization, and cut off connection with the whole being and disappear into the absolute, maybe silence of Buddha or the bliss of Shankara. That they can do because they do not insist upon carrying the whole being where they go. They ignore. That has not helped anybody.
Once that has happened, the ego
can't. It can't. After all, the ego is not a real person. It is a shadow. It is a shadow of the true person. And that shadow exists as long as that certain perverse knot continues, giving it a chance to continue. Once that is snapped, the true being emerges in his light without shadow. The gods, it is said in the Puranas, have no shadow. They don't sleep, their eyes don't wink, they carry no shadow. No, it doesn't mean that. One can be conscious of the divine even without that cosmic realization, certainly. To be conscious of the divine is one thing. To realize the divine is another. To embody and manifest the divine is still another thing. One is conscious at a point. One leaves it, leaves the divine in a certain, on a certain plane of living to begin with. That has to be extended. When this realization of the divine, this divine consciousness is organized, made to occupy the whole of the being, including the body, then can you say that one embodies the divine consciousness? It is a far cry from being conscious of the divine to be able to embody the divine.